Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, November 13, 2025. On the front page of the News Gazette, WILL Executive Director reassigned to advisory role. The Executive Director of a local NPR and PBS affiliate said that upcoming leadership changes within the organization are due to differences of opinion when it comes to planning for the future. Moss Bresnahan, who has led Illinois Public Media since 2014, is set to become an advisor in the office of Tracy Sulkin, Dean of the College of Media at the University of Illinois. Director of Development John Steinbecker and Director of Broadcast Operations Lily Duncanson will lead the IPM together starting November 16th. Duncanson said that her new title will be Director of Broadcast Operations and Content, while Steinbecker will serve as Director of Development, Budget, and Resource Planning. IPM is part of the College of Media, and there were simply differences of opinion in vision and strategy for IPM's future, Bresnahan told the News Gazette. The reorganization has unfolded in line with the dean's vision of the future. I look forward to supporting the new leadership team as they work with the staff to chart a path forward, and I believe strongly that there is a bright future ahead for IPM, Sulkin said. IPM is a unit within the College of Media, Duncanson said. The not-for-profit media service operates radio stations WILL AM 580, WILL FM 90.9, and WILL FM 101.1, Illinois Soul, as well as TV stations WILL TV, WILL World, WILL Create, and WILL Kids 24/7. Its operations also include the WILL online news website. Bresnahan said he'll still be focusing on public media-related issues in his new role. After 30 years at various PBS and NPR stations, and given the changes in our industry, it's an exciting time to do some study and research on the future of public media, he said. And I hope I can get students on campus interested in creating the next generation of public media programs. And since I love IPM, I'll continue to do whatever I can to support its programming and staff. The news comes a few months after Congress's decision in July to sign off on rescinding $1.1 billion that had been allocated to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for the next 2 years, including a total of approximately $3 million for IPM across the 2 years. The News Gazette's Kathy Reiser previously reported, the approximately $1.5 million per year from CPB accounting for 20% of IPM's budget, Bresnahan said. CPB announced last month that it is winding down its operations as a result of the cuts, which have also led to some staffing changes at IPM. We've had to let go of some staff in the last 3 months because of the cuts, Duncanson said. We're also going through a strategic plan right now to help us with what the future of public media, especially IPM, looks like. Steinbecker said that there are certain openings IPM has not filled. There are two full-time positions that I guess technically are getting laid off, but they're getting different positions with the university, he added. Steinbecker also noted that these changes occurred months ago, and there's no other current plan for any changes like that, he said. Duncanson said that the news regarding the IPM leadership is still fresh for staff who learned of the changes on Tuesday. With any change it's going to take, wonder how their life will change, she said. I think my main goal is to make sure that everyone can come to me and ask the questions they want and to be honest. Steinbecker likewise said that while there are always concerns that arise during a leadership transition, he feels that he and Duncanson will be able to alleviate these, especially since they are internal hires and longtime IPM staffers. As mentioned in IPM's article, certainly, I think the primary concern was that there was immediate plans for layoffs or that we might be taking on our roles to enact certain changes, and that couldn't be further from the truth, he said. Bresnahan said he feels that the organization is in a good place in terms of programming and support from donations. IPM is about $500,000 ahead of pace in its fundraising, he said, and the budget is stable even after the rescission of federal funds. He added that he is very proud of the IPM team as they go above and beyond during very challenging times and believes the station has a bright future. I love Illinois Public Media and the talented staff, so I'll miss the day-to-day involvement, Bresnahan said, but I'll continue to support IPM's programs and staff in any way I can. Unit 4 Superintendent Search, and there's a photo on the front page with the headline, First Large Forum Draws Small Crowd, and the caption is, what was billed as the first large community in-person forum to discuss the search for Champaign's next superintendent of schools drew a crowd of 4, matching the number of translators on hand Wednesday night at Centennial High School. Greg Anderson, Al Molina, and China Figueroa Dixon, accompanied by her Carrie Busey third-grade daughter, Denham Hill, took advantage of the access to the CEO of the Texas-based firm directing the search. They asked James Guerra questions on a range of topics, from candidates' bilingualism to the challenges Sheila Boozer's successor will face. Wednesday night's event at Centennial's Aldridge Auditorium followed the only scheduled small forum earlier in the day at the Champaign Public Library. Guerra will host 3 other similar events, all at 6 p.m., today at Garden Hills Academy, Monday at Barksdall Elementary, and Tuesday at Stratton Academy of the Arts, then return for a special school board meeting on December 1st, when he'll share what JG Consulting learned from the forums and an online survey that drew more than 1,000 responses. Champaign County Court, trial to determine if suspect is sexually dangerous. A bench trial for an Urbana man accused of criminal sexual abuse began Wednesday, but not to determine whether he is guilty of the current charges. Champaign County Judge Chad Beckett oversaw the beginnings of proceedings as to whether 23-year-old Delonte Helm should be considered a sexually dangerous person under Illinois Sexually Dangerous Persons Act. The act defines such a person as an individual suffering from a mental disorder for at least a year who has a propensity to the commission of sex offenses and has demonstrated that propensity. Designating an individual as a sexually dangerous person means that should they be sentenced to the Illinois Department of Corrections, they may be handled differently from the general population. Sexually dangerous people are also eligible for care and treatment to recover from that status. According to court records, Helm has multiple open cases regarding charges of aggravated criminal sexual abuse of a child over 5 years old, alongside a case of criminal sexual abuse and aggravated battery in a public place. Assistant State's Attorney Joel Fletcher presented his first witness, a forensic psychologist, who said that he'd performed examinations on a handful of other individuals undergoing the same considerations. The psychologist said that his review of Helm's record of previous psychological evaluations, along with his own interview with the defendant, led him to determine that Helm should in fact be considered a sexually dangerous person. Based on his own and those previous evaluations, the psychologist that Helm likely has fetal alcohol syndrome, which appears to have affected his cognitive abilities across the board. In addition to fetal alcohol syndrome, he said that he would label Helm as having an intellectual developmental disorder, but said that these two things were linked according to some research. Fletcher referenced a previous incident in which Helm apparently threatened to blow up the Urbana Free Library, and the psychologist said this kind of thing typified the cognitive challenges Helm faces when dealing with stress. He reacted without thinking and lashed out in a major way. The psychologist also said that Helm's lack of insight and awareness about alleged sexual behavior, especially with underage individuals, could be tied to those same challenges. Another concern the psychologist brought up in relation to fetal alcohol syndrome is decreased life expectancy. Should Helm be sentenced to prison, he would have significantly less time to pursue rehabilitation than many of his peers. In response to questions from public defender Elizabeth Pollock, representing Helm, the psychologist said that treatments for some in the same situation as Helm might not help him because fetal alcohol syndrome cannot be cured. This bench trial is set to continue Thursday after Beckett determines Helm's status. The case can continue forward with determinations of how to handle his pending charges and eventual possible sentencing. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Thanks to 364 students from 53 area high schools who on Sunday visited our newsroom for year 14 of Faces of Winter. Not only did we continue our expansion into Macon County, we're up to 10 schools, but officially welcomed bowlers, archers, dancers, cheerleaders, and even a mascot into the mix. Gibson City Melvin Sibley's Fergie was a feathered hit. It was a wonderfully eclectic and hectic scene. Since 2012, more than 11,400 kids, all in uniform, many accompanied by parents, have taken part in a project that involves portraits, interviews, autographs, radio spots, and a heavy dose of social media. After Thanksgiving, we'll begin publishing the work of photographers Robin Scholes and Rob Lacates, as well as Q&As with sports editor Matt Daniels in print editions. Finally, producers Ed Bond and Dave Leake steered more than 150 students through the always popular radio process. Those spots will begin airing on WDWS later this month. Faces of Spring will take place in late February. Teacher of the Week, Michael Stevens, band director, Muhammad Seymour High School. The band will play on. Michael Stevens' 33-year career as Muhammad Seymour's band director, which will end when he retires at the end of the school year, has been highlighted by numerous awards and trips for the marching band to prestigious stages like the Fiesta Bowl and Rose Bowl. His impact has been felt, though, in many ways. Throughout his time here, he has inspired generations of students, both in the classroom and on the practice field, by instilling the values of hard work, teamwork, and a competitive spirit. Principal Chad Benedict said, "Mr. Stevens' impact extends far beyond music. He has shaped countless students' character, confidence, and experiences, leaving a legacy that will continue to resonate long after his retirement. I teach music because music is a culturally significant part of our lives and an incredible way to express oneself. Plus, it's a great way to build community, and of course, it's fun. I also love seeing students working together and finding success. Finally, the life lessons learned in a performing ensemble stay with you your entire life. I became a teacher because I found music hard I found music had become my passion. My high band director also saw this in me and encouraged my path. My favorite aspects of teaching are creating and rehearsing our marching band show with all of its intricacies and movement and musical nuance. I also love creating awesome musical aesthetics with the students in the wind ensemble and preparing the jazz big band for competition and jazz night. It's also so rewarding to see the kids proudly shine in our performances and competitions throughout the school year. The most fulfilling parts of my job are when students feel pride in what we do and realize the impact music can have on themselves and others. It's also very heartening to have former students return and say how much my class has made an impact on their lives. Students feel engaged when they feel ownership in the music program. They want to carry on their traditions of success and pass those experiences on to the younger students. That motivation to excel and pride in one's accomplishments keeps the program moving forward. Something else I'm passionate about is I don't have a lot of time to be passionate about many other things, but when I do have downtime, it's spending time with my wife, our family, and our grandchildren. My favorite teacher I had in school was Paul Hinman, my high school band director. He taught me that the work ethic that I have continued to preach to my bands throughout the years. If I weren't teaching, I would be. Since this is my last year teaching, I will retire in May. The thing I most like to do is having a great retirement by spending more time with my wife and family, spending and playing my saxophone. Mike Hale's Records and Radio column. Online streaming harkens back to radio's clear channel days. Before today's radio topic, a shout out to Gary Trust. Trust serves as Billboard's New York-based Managing Director of Charts, Data Operations, and Editorial Analysis. He is the guardian of the iconic Billboard Hot 100. Every few days, he cranks out some nuggets of trivia that create great thought starters for me. I have written well over 8,000 music trivia questions for my daily 97.5 WHMS 745 morning show feature, so I truly need all the help I can get. Trust research, along with so many listeners sharing ideas, it keeps the 40-plus year feature fresh. Earlier this week, Trust shared that Michael Jackson made history as the first artist to score a top 10 song in six different decades. Thanks to enormous Halloween-related sales, streams, and radio airplay, the song Thriller returned to the top 10 of the Billboard Hot 100. Here's the question. With Michael Jackson's ascent to having a top 10 song in six different decades, 70s, 80s, 90s, 1000s, 10s, and now 20s, who is the only solo singer who has scored top 10 songs in five different decades? Excuse me. We've had a lot of discussion in columns over the last several months on the true power of 50,000-watt AM radio stations back in the day. Whether it was baseball or music radio, the attraction of listening to long-distance stations held some magic. Fast forward to now, I received a note from longtime Mike in the Morning listeners, Matt and Ginny Locken. The Lockens are not your typical listeners, as they moved away from CU almost 30 years ago and haven't been back, but they still listen via streaming. Has it been almost 30 years since radio stations became available via streaming? Locally, WILL was the first to give listeners with dial-up modems a chance to hear CU radio theoretically anywhere in the world. Quickly followed by Jay Pierce's WEBX 93.5 The Web and the original WKIO 92.5 Oldies 92. WKIO's streaming entry was via local startup tech firm Saltec. Early on, the Real Audio Player was the first widely used product for receiving radio stations online. The early days, unless you were fortunate to have access to an Ethernet line, you were listening via a telephone dial-up modem. Lots of buffering, disconnects. You couldn't use a modem during a serious thunderstorm for fear the phone line would blow out the audio card on your computer. For WKIO, it was so interesting to look at the Soltech printouts of where servers around the world were accessing our station. A radio geek like me had access to listening to some great stations at any time: KOMA Oklahoma City, WLTW New York, Capital Gold London, BBC Two, CBS FM, WJI Cleveland were among my favorites while programming Oldies 92. When the turn of the century came along, streaming radio went from the wild, wild west to so many entities wanting to get a piece of the action from station owners, even though station owners were having a hard time figuring out how to monetize streaming. The uncertainty of looming streaming costs for commercial broadcasters forced hundreds of stations, including ours, to pull the plug. Finally, with some clarity regarding the future of streaming, stations came back online. The last big hurdle for local radio stations that stream was sports play-by-play broadcasts. We were blessed that problem faded away. Today, more people are listening to our stations streaming at home, at work, in the car, on earbuds, and on a myriad of smart devices. Simply, we have reached a cool time in broadcasting where listeners have access to our products from the platform of their choosing. One of the things many radio stations have done is geofenced where their streams can be received. For example, they might only allow streaming within 75 miles of their market. We continue to let the entire world listen to our WDWS, WHMS, WKIO, and WDWS FM streams. When Penny for Your Thoughts, Sports Talk, or Illini pre- and post-game shows and play-by-play are streaming, the numbers are staggering from outside the state of Illinois. Streaming radio in 2025 is a throwback to the 50,000-watt AM clear channel days. You now have access to radio everywhere. As a lifelong student of radio, I continue to learn from broadcasters and personalities everywhere. After 30 years of streaming, my go-to stations outside of CU, WLTW Light FM and WINS All News New York, WTOP All News in D.C., WHB Sports Radio Kansas City, WMGK Classic Rock Philly, Arrow 103.5, Classic Rock Salt Lake, BBC Radio 2, Smooth Radio, Smooth Country, Golden Magic in London. Yep, I'm a radio geek. Thanks for your feedback and column suggestions. I appreciate it. Illinois congressional candidate and five others plead not guilty. All were charged with conspiring to block agent from entering facility. Congressional candidate and digital creator Catherine Cat Abogazala and five co-defendants pleaded not guilty Wednesday on federal charges of conspiring to block a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent from entering ICE's facility in West Suburban Broadview during a protest in September. Abogazala, 26, who is running for the 9th Congressional District seat, was indicted last month along with Cook County Board candidate Catherine Cat Sharp, 29, 45th Ward Democratic Committeeman Michael Rabbit, 62, and Oak Park Trustee Brian Straw, 38, all of whom are Democrats. Also charged were Andre Martin, 27, of Providence, Rhode Island, and Jocelyn Walsh, 31, of Chicago. It was unclear if they had any personal connection to any of the other defendants. According to the 11-page indictment, the group surrounded an ICE vehicle outside the Broadview facility during a September 26 protest and banged aggressively on the vehicle's side and back windows, hood, and doors before they crowded together in the front and side of the government vehicle and pushed against the vehicle to hinder and impede its movements. Prosecutors allege the protesters scratched the vehicle's body, broke a side mirror and a rear windshield wiper, and etched the word pig into the paint. The indictment includes the conspiracy count, which carries a maximum sentence of 6 years in federal prison, as well as several other counts of impeding a federal officer, each punishable by up to 1 year in federal prison. The charges have been met by accusations that the Department of Justice was prosecuting free speech and trying to punish political opponents. Before all six defendants appeared for their arraignment before U.S. Magistrate Judge Heather McShane at the Dirksen U.S. Courthouse, dozens of protesters gathered under the red sculpted arches in the Federal Plaza across the outside, chanting, "Fascist ICE has got to go," and other slogans in support of those who were indicted. "We support the Broadview 6," protesters chanted at one point. Sharp appeared briefly and hugged supporters. "They're doing anything possible to distract, to divide, to attack," Chicago Alderman Andre Vasquez, 40th, for whom Sharp has served as chief of staff, said, "The people will continue to show up every single time." After the hearing, Abogazala is scheduled to hold a rally and news conference in Federal Plaza across the street from the courthouse. Minutes after the indictment went public last month, Abogazala announced the charges in a statement on social media. "This political prosecution is an attack on all of our First Amendment rights," she said. "I'm not backing down, and we're going to win." Sharp's attorney, Molly Armour, released a statement calling the charges ludicrous. "We are confident that a jury will see them for exactly what they are, an effort by the Trump administration to frighten people out of participating in protest and exercising their First Amendment rights," she said. Straw, meanwhile, released a statement through his attorneys, Damon Chironis and Christopher Parente, blasting the charges as baseless and saying he will continue to stand with and protect our immigrant neighbors. "I joined the protest at the Broadview ICE detention facility because of what is happening to our immigrant neighbors. Children zip-tied and shoved into vans, mothers pulled from cars on the way to school, neighbors afraid to go to church or work." Straw's statement read, "The Trump Justice Department's decision to seemingly handpick public officials like me for standing up against these inhumane policies will not deter me from fulfilling my oath of office." Abogazala, also known around the internet as Cat Abu, has made a name for herself nationally with TikTok videos and on podcasts by blasting veteran Democrats for not doing enough to combat President Donald Trump. She is among a crowded field running to replace U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky in the 9th Congressional District, which covers part of Chicago's far north side, as well as several north and northwest suburbs. She has been a frequent participant in protests at the Broadview ICE facility and has made her presence there a key component of her campaign. Evanston Mayor Daniel Bliss, another candidate for the 9th District seat, has also attended the protests. He was not charged. A video of the incident described in the indictment has been widely circulated online. It shows the immigration agent's black SUV rolling slowly through a crowd of people as they chant, "Up, up with liberation, down, down with deportation," and other slogans. Abu Ghazala is briefly visible wearing a white t-shirt and chanting near the vehicle's left passenger door, among others, trying to block its movement. Other protesters were seen banging on the hood and windows of the SUV and slowly backing up as it moved down Harvard Street toward the processing center, amid cries of shame, the sounds of whistles and thrown plush toys that lodged on the vehicle's windshield and hood could also be heard and seen. As the vehicle made it into the parking lot, the sound of pepper spray balls being shot by federal agents could be heard on the video, and the protesters scattered as they exploded around them. Meanwhile, in another video from a different protest last month, Abu Ghazala could be seen being picked up and thrown to the ground by federal agents. Journey's final frontier tour includes stop in Champaign. 4.5 decades after its first visit to the State Farm Center Journey is heading back to the State Farm Center for a sixth show. Tickets go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday for the June 20th concert, part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band's 60-city Final Frontier Tour of North America. The lineup is the same as it was during the band's last local appearance in 2023, headlined by Steve Perry's successor, Arnel Pineda, on lead vocals and Journey co-founder Neil Schoen on lead guitar. This tour is our heartfelt thank you to the fans who've been with us every step of the way, through every song, every era, every high and low, Schoen said. We're pulling out all the stops with a brand new production. The hits, the deep cuts, the energy, the spectacle. It's a full circle celebration of the music that's brought us all together. Journey is the third act booked for a State Farm Center concert in 2026. Announced earlier, Big Time Rush, January 24th, and Cody Johnson, February 13th. Cleanup of gunman's fire-destroyed home saw it. Several lime green cones, each inscribed with City of Gibson, lined the roadway Wednesday morning near the dead end of Ash Street in a cul-de-sac at the city's southwest edge. On a property just beyond the barrier sat a pile of scorched debris, once the home of a now infamous resident, David B. Jordan, but now an unsafe and unsightly mess. The residence at 146 West Ash Street in the Cedar Subdivision, Cinder Subdivision, suddenly went up in flames not long after the 70-year-old Jordan shot two law enforcement officers who were responding to a complaint that he was walking around in his yard naked during the early morning hours of August 9th. In the nearly 14 weeks since, authorities have been searching for Jordan, who mysteriously disappeared after the shooting, but have been unable to find him. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, November 13th, 2025. Please stay tuned for Part 2.